two clipboards. The shortwave under the dash crackled and sputtered. Unit 4, come in. 4, do you copy? I reached under and turned it off, banging my knuckles on something as I searched for the right toggle switch. It was a shotgun, pump action, probably the cop's personal property. I unclipped it and handed it to Nona. She put it on her lap. I backed the cruiser up. It was dented, but otherwise not hurt. It had snow tires, and they bit nicely once we got over the ice that had done the damage. Then we were in Castle Rock. The houses, except for an occasional shanty trailer set back from the road, had disappeared. The road itself hadn't been plowed yet, and there were no tracks except the ones we were leaving behind us. Monolithic fir trees, weighted with snow, towered all around us, and they made me feel tiny and insignificant. Just some tiny morsel caught in the throat of this night. It was now after 10 o'clock. I didn't see much of college social life during my freshman year at the university. I studied hard and worked in the library shelving books and repairing bindings and learning how to catalog. In the spring, there was JV baseball. Near the end of the academic year, just before finals, there was a dance at the gym. I was at loose ends, studied up for my first two tests, and I wandered down. I had the buck admission, so I went in. It was dark and crowded and sweaty and frantic as only a college social before the acts of finals can be. There was sex in the air. You didn't have to smell it. You could almost reach out and grab it in both hands like a wet piece of heavy cloth. You knew that love was going to be made later on, or what passes for love. People were going to make it under bleachers and in the steam plant parking lot and in apartments and dormitory rooms. It was going to be made by desperate man-boys with the draft one step behind them, and by pretty co-eds who were going to drop out this year and go home and start a family. It would be made with tears and laughter, drunk and sober, stiffly and with no inhibition, but mostly it would be made quickly. There were a few stags, but not many. It wasn't a night you needed to go anyplace stag. I drifted down by the raised bandstand. As I got closer to the sound, the beat, the music got to be a palpable thing. The group had a half circle of 5-foot amplifiers behind them, and you could feel your eardrums flapping in and out with the bass signature. I leaned up against the wall and watched. The dancers moved in prescribed patterns, as if they were trios instead of couples, the third invisible but between, being humped from the front and back. Feet moving through the sawdust that had been sprinkled over the varnished floor. I didn't see anybody I knew, and I began to feel lonely, but pleasantly so. I was at that stage of the evening where you fantasize that everyone is looking at you, the romantic stranger, out of the corners of their eyes. About a half hour later, I went out and got a Coke in the lobby. When I went back in, somebody had started a circle dance, and I was pulled in, my arms around the shoulders of two girls I had never seen before. We went around and around. There were maybe 200 people in the circle, and it covered half the gym floor. Then part of it collapsed, and 20 or 30 people formed another circle in the middle of the first and started to go around the other way. It made me feel dizzy. I saw a girl who looked like Betsy Mlanfant, but I knew that was a fantasy. When I looked for her again, I couldn't see her or anyone who looked like her. When the thing finally broke up, I felt weak and not at all well. I made my way back over to the bleachers and sat down. The music was too loud, the air too greasy. My mind kept pitching and yawing. I could hear my heartbeat in my head, the way you do after you throw the biggest drunk of your life. I used to think what happened next happened because I was tired and a little nauseated from going around and around. But as I said before, all this writing has brought everything into sharper focus. I can't believe that anymore. I looked up at them again, all the beautiful, hurrying people in the semi-darkness. It seemed to me that all the men looked terrified, their faces elongated into grotesque slow-motion masks. It was understandable. The women, co-eds in their sweaters, short skirts, their bell-bottoms, were all turning into rats. At first it didn't frighten me. I even chuckled. I knew what I was seeing was some kind of hallucination, and for a while, I could watch it almost clinically. Then some girl stood on tiptoe to kiss her fellow, and that was too much. Hairy, twisted face with black buckshot eyes reaching up, mouth spreading to reveal teeth. I left. I stood in the lobby for a moment, half distracted. There was a bathroom down the hall, but I went past it and up the stairs. The locker room was on the third floor, and I had to run the last flight. I pulled the door open and ran for one of the bathroom stalls. I threw up amid the mixed smells of liniment, sweaty uniforms, oiled leather. The music was far away down there, the silence up here virginal. I felt comforted. We had to come to a stop sign at Southwest Bend. The memory of the dance had left me excited for a reason I didn't understand. I began to shake. She looked at me, smiling with her dark eyes. "Now?" I couldn't answer her. I was shaking too badly for that. She nodded slowly for me. I drove onto a spur of Route 7 that must have been a logging road in the summertime. I didn't drive in too deeply because I was afraid of getting stuck. I popped off the headlights and flecks of snow began to gather silently on the windshield. "Do you love?" she asked, almost kindly. Some kind of sound kept escaping me, being dragged out of me. I think it must have been a close oral counterpart to the thoughts of a rabbit caught in a snare. "Here," she said, "right here." It was ecstasy. We almost didn't get back onto the main road. The snowplow had gone by, orange lights winking and flashing in the night, throwing up a huge wall of snow in our way. There was a shovel in the trunk of the police car. It took me half an hour to dig out, and by then it was almost midnight. She turned on the police radio while I was doing it, and it told us what we had to know. The bodies of Blanchette and the kid from the pickup truck had been found. They suspected that we had taken the cruiser. The cop's name had been Asijin, and that's a funny name. There used to be a major league ball player named Asijin. I think he played for the Dodgers. Maybe I had killed one of his relatives. It didn't bother me to know the cop's name. He had been following too close, and he had gotten in our way. We drove back onto the main road. I could feel her excitement, high and hot and burning. I stopped long enough to clear the windshield with my arm, and then we were going again. We went through West Castle Rock, and I knew without having to be told where to turn. A snow-crusted sign said it was Stackpole Road. The plow had not been here, but one vehicle had been through before us. The tracks of its tires were still freshly cut in the blowing, restless snow. A mile, then less than a mile. Her fierce eagerness, her need, came to me, and I began to feel jumpy again. We came around a curve, and there was the power truck. Bright orange body and warning flashers pulsing the color of blood. It was blocking the road. You can't imagine her rage, our rage, really, because now, after what happened, we were really one. You can't imagine the sweeping feeling of intense paranoia, the conviction that every hand was now turned against us. There were two of them. One was a bending shadow in the darkness ahead. The other was holding a flashlight. He came toward us, his light bobbing like a lurid eye. And there was more than hate. There was fear. Fear that it was all going to be snatched away from us at the last moment. He was yelling and I cranked down my window. "You can't get through here. Go on back by the Bowen Road. We've got a live line down here. You can't..." I got out of the car, lifted the shotgun, and gave him both barrels. He was flung back against the orange truck, and I staggered back against the cruiser. He slipped down an inch at a time, staring at me incredulously, and then he fell into the snow. "Are there more shells?" I asked Nona. "Yes." She gave them to me. I broke the shotgun, ejected the spent cartridges, and put in new ones. The guy's buddy had straightened up and was watching incredulously. He shouted something at me that was lost in the wind. It sounded like a question, but it didn't matter. I was going to kill him. I walked toward him, and he just stood there looking at me. He didn't move, even when I raised the shotgun. I don't think he had any conception of what was happening. I think he thought it was a dream. I fired one barrel and was low. A great flurry of snow exploded up, coating him. Then he bellowed a great, terrified scream and ran, taking one gigantic bound over the fallen power cable in the road. I fired the other barrel and missed again. Then he was gone into the dark, and I could forget him. He wasn't in our way anymore. I went back to the cruiser. "We'll have to walk," I said. We walked past the fallen body, stepped over the spitting power line, and walked up the road, following the widely spaced tracks of the fleeing man. Some of the drifts were almost up to her knees, but she was always a little ahead of me. We were both panting. We came over a hill and descended into a narrow dip. On one side was a leaning, deserted shed with glassless windows. She stopped and gripped my arm. "There," she said, and pointed across to the other side. Her grip was strong and painful, even through my coat. Her face was set in a glaring, triumphant rictus. "There. There." It was a graveyard. We slipped and stumbled up the banking and clambered over a snow-covered stone wall. I had been here too, of course. My real mother had come from Castle Rock, and although she and my father had never lived there, this was where the family plot had been. It was a gift to my mother from her parents, who had lived and died in Castle Rock. During the thing with Betsy, I had come here often to read the poems of John Keats and Percy Shelley. I suppose you think that was a silly, sophomoric thing to do, but I don't. Not even now. I felt close to them, comforted. After Ace Merrill beat me up, I never went there again. Not until Nona led me there. I slipped and fell in the loose powder, twisting my ankle. I got up and walked on it, using the shotgun as a crutch. The silence was infinite and unbelievable. The snow fell in soft, straight lines, mounding atop the leaning stones and crosses, burying all but the tips of the corroded flag holders that would only hold flags on Memorial Day and Veterans Day. The silence was unholy in its immensity, and for the first time, I felt terror. She led me toward a stone building set into the rise of the hill at the back of the cemetery, a vault, a snow-whited sepulcher. She had a key. I knew she would have a key, and she did. She blew the snow away from the door's flange and found the keyhole. The sound of the turning tumblers seemed to scratch across the darkness. She leaned on the door, and it swung inward. The odor that came out at us was as cool as autumn, as cool as the air in the Hollis root cellar. I could see in only a little way. There were dead leaves on the stone floor. She entered, paused, looked back over her shoulder at me. "No," I said. "Do you love?" she asked and laughed at me. I stood in the darkness, feeling everything begin to run together, past, present, future. I wanted to run screaming, run fast enough to take back everything I had done. Nona stood there looking at me, the most beautiful girl in the world, the only thing that had ever been mine. She made a gesture with her hands on her body. I'm not going to tell you what it was. You would know it if you saw it. I went in. She closed the door. It was dark, but I could see perfectly well. The place was alight with a slowly running green fire. It ran over the walls and snaked across the leaf-littered floor in tongues. There was a bier in the center of the vault, but it was empty. Withered rose petals were scattered across it like an ancient bridal offering. She beckoned to me, then pointed to the small door at the rear. Small, unmarked door. I dreaded it. I think I knew then. She had used me and laughed at me. Now she would destroy me. But I couldn't stop. I went to that door because I had to. The mental telegraph was still working at what I felt was glee, a terrible, insane glee and triumph. My hand trembled toward the door. It was coated with green fire. I opened the door and saw what was there. It was the girl. My girl. Dead. Her eyes stared vacantly into that October vault, into my own eyes. She smelled of stolen kisses. She was naked, and she had been ripped open from throat to crotch, her whole body turned into a womb. And something lived in there. The rats. I could not see them, but I could hear them rustling inside her. I knew that in a moment her dry mouth would open, and she would ask me if I loved. I backed away, my whole body numb, my brain floating on a dark cloud. I turned to Nona. She was laughing, holding her arms out to me. And with a sudden blaze of understanding, I knew the last test, the last final. I had passed it, and I was free. I turned back to the doorway, and of course it was nothing but an empty stone closet with dead leaves on the floor. I went to Nona. I went to my life. Her arms reached around my neck, and I pulled her against me. That was when she began to change, to ripple and run like wax. The great dark eyes became small and beady. The hair coarsened, went brown. The nose shortened, the nostrils dilated. Her body lumped and hunched against me. I was being embraced by a rat. Do you love? It squealed. Do you love? Do you love? Her lipless mouth stretched upward for mine. I didn't scream. There were no screams left. I doubt if I will ever scream again. It's so hot in here. I don't mind the heat, not really. I like to sweat if I can shower. I've always thought of sweat as a good thing, a masculine thing. But sometimes, in the heat, there are bugs that bite. Spiders, for instance. Did you know that female spiders sting and eat their mates? They do, right after copulation. Also, I've heard scurryings in the walls. I don't like that. I've given myself writer's cramp, and the felt tip of the pen is all soft and mushy. But I'm done now. And things look different. It doesn't seem the same anymore at all. Do you realize that for a while they almost had me believing that I did all those horrible things myself? Those men from the truck stop, the guy from the power truck who got away? They said I was alone. I was alone when they found me, almost frozen to death in that graveyard by the stones that mark my father, my mother, my brother Drake. But that only means she left. You can see that. Any fool could. But I'm glad she got away. Truly, I am. But you must realize she was with me all the time, every step of the way. I'm going to kill myself now. It will be much better. I'm tired. Of all the guilt and agony and bad dreams. And also, I don't like the noises in the walls. Anybody could be in there. Or anything. I'm not crazy. I know that. And I trust that you do too. If you say you aren't crazy, that's supposed to mean you are. But I'm beyond all those little games. She was with me. She was real. I love her. True love will never die. That's how I signed all my letters to Betsy, the ones I tore up. But Nona was the only one I ever really loved. It's so hot in here, and I don't like the sounds in the walls. Do you love? Yes, I love. And true love will never die.
For Owen. Read by David Morse.
Walking to school, you ask me, what other schools have grades? I get as far as Fruit Street, and your eyes go away. As we walk under these yellow trees, you have your army lunchbox under one arm, and your short legs, dressed in combat fatigues, make your shadow into a scissors that cuts nothing on the sidewalk. You tell me suddenly that all the students there are fruits. Everyone picks on the blueberries because they are so small. The bananas, you say, are patrol boys. In your eyes, I see homerooms of oranges, assemblies of apples. All, you say, have arms and legs. And the watermelons are often tardy. They waddle, and they are fat. Like me, you say. I could tell you things, but better not. That watermelon children cannot tie their own shoes. The plums do it for them. Or how I steal your face. Steal it and wear it for my own. It wears out fast on my face. It's the stretching that does it. I could tell you that dying's an art, and I am learning fast. In that school, I think you have already picked up your own pencil and begun to write your name. Between now and then, I suppose we could someday play you truant and drive over to Fruit Street, and I could park in a rain of these October leaves, and we could watch a banana escort the last tardy watermelon through those tall doors.
Survivor Type. Read by Norbert Leo Butz.
Sooner or later, the question comes up in every medical student's career. How much shock trauma can the patient stand? Different instructors answer the question in different ways, but cut to its base level, the answer is always another question. How badly does the patient want to survive? January 26. 2 days since the storm washed me up. I paced the island off just this morning. Some island. It is 190 paces wide at its thickest point and 267 paces long from tip to tip. So far as I can tell, there is nothing on it to eat. My name is Richard Pine. This is my diary. If I'm found, when? I can destroy this easily enough. There is no shortage of matches. Matches and heroin. Plenty of both. Neither of them worth doodly squat here, ha-ha. So I will write. It will pass the time anyway. If I'm to tell the whole truth, and why not, I sure have the time, I'll have to start by saying I was born Richard Panzetti in New York's Little Italy. My father was an old world guinea. I wanted to be a surgeon. My father would laugh, call me crazy, and tell me to get him another glass of wine. He died of cancer when he was 46. I was glad. I played football in high school. I was the best damn football player my school ever produced. Quarterback. I made all-city my last 2 years. I hated football. But if you're a poor wop from the projects and you want to go to college, sports are your only ticket. So I played, and I got my athletic scholarship. In college, I only played ball until my grades were good enough to get a full academic scholarship. Pre-med. My father died 6 weeks before graduation. Good deal. Do you think I wanted to walk across that stage and get my diploma and look down and see that fat greaseball sitting there? Does a hen want a flag? I got into a fraternity, too. It wasn't one of the good ones, not with a name like Panzetti, but a fraternity all the same. Why am I writing this? It's almost funny. No, I take that back. It is funny. The great Dr. Pine, sitting on a rock in his pajama bottoms and t-shirt, sitting on an island almost small enough to spit across, writing his life story. Damn, I'm hungry. Never mind. I'll write my goddamn life story if I want to. At least it keeps my mind off my stomach. Sort of. I changed my name to Pine before I started med school. My mother said I was breaking her heart. Huh, what heart? The day after my old man was in the ground, she was out hustling that Jew grocer down the end of the block. For someone who loved the name so much, she was in one hell of a hurry to change her copy of it to Steinbrunner. Surgery was all I ever wanted, ever since high school. Even then, I was wrapping my hands before every game and soaking them afterward. If you want to be a surgeon, you have to take care of your hands. Some of the kids used to rag me about it, call me chicken shit. I never fought them. Playing football was risk enough, but there were ways. The one that got on my case most was Howie Plotsky, a big dumb bohunk with zits all over his face. They had a paper route, and I was selling the numbers along with the papers. I had a little coming in lots of ways. You get to know people, you listen, you make connections. You have to when you're hustling the street. Any asshole knows how to die. The thing to learn is how to survive, you know what I mean? So I paid the biggest kid in school, Ricky Brotzy, $10 to make Howie Plotsky's mouth disappear. Make it disappear, I said. I will pay you $1 for every tooth you bring me. Rico brought me 3 teeth wrapped up in a paper towel. He dislocated 2 of his knuckles doing the job, so you see the kind of trouble I could have got into. In med school, while the other suckers were running themselves ragged trying to bone up, no pun intended, haha, between waiting tables or selling neckties or buffing floors, I kept the rackets going. Football pools, basketball pools, little policy. I stayed on good terms with the old neighborhood, and I got through school just fine. I didn't get into pushing until I was doing my residency. I was working in one of the biggest hospitals in New York City. At first it was just prescription blanks. I'd sell a tablet of 100 blanks to some guy from the neighborhood, and he'd forge the names of 40 or 50 different doctors on them using writing samples I'd also sell him. The guy would turn around and peddle the blanks on the street for $10 or $20 apiece. The speed freaks and the nodders loved it. And after a while, I found out just how much of a balls up the hospital drug room was in. Nobody knew what was coming in or going out. There were people lugging the goodies out by the double handfuls. Not me. I was always careful and never got into trouble until I got careless and unlucky. But I'm going to land on my feet. I always do. Can't write anymore now. My wrist's tired and the pencil's dull. I don't know why I'm bothering anyway. Somebody will probably pick me up soon. January 27. The boat drifted away last night and sank in about 10 feet of water off the north side of the island. Who gives a rip? The bottom was like Swiss cheese after coming over the reef anyway. I'd already taken off anything that was worth taking. 4 gallons of water, a sewing kit, a first aid kit. This book I'm writing in, which is supposed to be a lifeboat inspection log. Ha, that's a laugh. Whoever heard of a lifeboat with no food on it? The last report in here is August 8, 1970. Oh, yes, 2 knives. 1 dull and 1 fairly sharp. 1 combination fork and spoon. I'll use them when I eat my supper tonight. Roast rock. Ha ha. Well, I did get my pencil sharpened. When I get off this pile of guano-splattered rock, I'm gonna sue the bloody hell out of Paradise Lines, Inc. That alone is worth living for. And I am going to live. I'm going to get out of this. Make no mistake about it. I am going to get out of this. Later. When I was making my inventory, I forgot one thing. 2 kilos of pure heroin. Worth about $350,000. New York street value. Here, it's worth el zilcho. Sort of funny, isn't it? Ha ha. January 28. Well, I've eaten, if you want to call that eating. There was a gull perched on one of the rocks at the center of the island. The rocks were all jumbled up into a kind of mini mountain there, all covered with bird shit, too. I got a chunk of stone that just fitted into my hand and climbed up as close to it as I dared. It just stood there on its rock, watching me with its bright black eyes. I'm surprised that the rumbling of my stomach didn't scare it off. I threw the rock as hard as I could and hit it broadside. It let out a loud squawk and tried to fly away, but I'd broken its right wing. I scrambled up after it and it hopped away. I could see the blood trickling over its white feathers. The son of a bitch led me a merry chase. Once on the other side of the central rock pile, I got my foot caught in a hole between two rocks and nearly fractured my ankle. It began to tire at last, and I finally caught it on the east side of the island. It was actually trying to get into the water and paddle away. I caught a handful of its tail feathers, and it turned around and pecked me. Then I had one hand around its feet. I got my other hand on its miserable neck and broke it. The sound gave me great satisfaction. Lunch is served, you know. Ha ha. I carried it back to my camp, but even before I plucked it and gutted it, I used iodine to swab the laceration its beak had made. Birds carry all sorts of germs, and the last thing I need now is an infection. The operation on the gull went quite smoothly. I could not cook it, alas. Absolutely no vegetation or driftwood on the island, and the boat has sunk. So I ate it raw. My stomach wanted to regurgitate it immediately. I sympathized, but could not allow it. I counted backward until the nausea passed. It almost always works. Can you imagine that bird almost breaking my ankle and then pecking me? If I catch another one tomorrow, I'll torture it. I let this one off too easily. Even as I write, I am able to glance down at its severed head on the sand. Its black eyes, even with the death glaze on them, seem to be mocking me. Do gulls have brains in any quantity? Are they edible? January 29. No chow today. One gull landed near the top of the rock pile but flew off before I could get close enough to throw it a forward pass. Ha ha. I've started a beard. It's just like hell. If the gull comes back and I get it, I'm going to cut its eyes out before I kill it. I was one hell of a surgeon, as I believe I may have said. They drummed me out. It's a laugh, really. They all do it, and they're so bloody sanctimonious when someone gets caught at it. Screw you, Jack, I got mine. The second oath of Hippocrates and hypocrites. I had enough socked away from my adventures as an intern and a resident. That's supposed to be like an officer and a gentleman, according to the oath of hypocrites, but don't you believe it. To set myself up in practice on Park Avenue. A good thing for me, too. I had no rich daddy or established patron as so many of my colleagues did. By the time my shingle was out, my father was 9 years in his pauper's grave. My mother died the year before my license to practice was revoked. It was a kickback thing. I had a deal going with half a dozen East Side pharmacists, with two drug supply houses, and with at least 20 other doctors. Patients were sent to me, and I sent patients. I performed operations and prescribed the correct post-op drugs. Not all the operations were necessary, but I never performed one against the patient's will. And I never had a patient look down at what was written on the prescript blank and say, I don't want this. Listen, they'd have a hysterectomy in 1965 or a partial thyroid in 1970 and still be taking painkillers 5 or 10 years later if you'd let them. Sometimes I did. I wasn't the only one, you know. They could afford the habit. And sometimes a patient would have trouble sleeping after minor surgery or trouble getting diet pills or Librium. It could all be arranged. Ha, yes. If they hadn't gotten it from me, they would have gotten it from someone else. Then the tax people got to Lowenthal. That sheep. They waved 5 years in his face and he coughed up half a dozen names. One of them was mine. They watched me for a while, and by the time they landed, I was worth a lot more than 5 years. There were a few other deals, including the prescription blanks, which I hadn't given up entirely. It's funny, I didn't really need that stuff anymore, but it was a habit. Hard to give up that extra sugar. Well, I knew some people, I pulled some strings, and I threw a couple of people to the wolves. Nobody I liked, though. Everyone I gave to the feds was a real son of a bitch. Christ, I'm hungry. January 30. No gulls today. Reminds me of the signs you'd sometimes see on the pushcarts back in the neighborhood. No tomatoes today. I walked out into the water up to my waist with the sharp knife in my hand. I stood completely still in that one place with the sun beating down on me for 4 hours. Twice I thought I was going to faint, but I counted backward until it passed. I didn't see one fish. Not one. January 31. Killed another gull, the same way I did the first. I was too hungry to torture it the way I had been promising myself. I gutted and ate it. Squeezed the tripes and then ate them too. It's strange how you can feel your vitality surge back. I was beginning to get scared there for a while. Lying in the shade of the big central rock pile, I think I was hearing voices. My father, my mother, my ex-wife. And worst of all, the big chink who sold me the heroin in Saigon. He had a lisp, possibly from a partially cleft palate. "Go ahead," his voice came out of nowhere. "Go ahead and snort a little. You will notice how hungry you are then. It's beautiful." But I've never done dope, not even sleeping pills. Lowenthal killed himself, did I tell you that? That sheep. He hanged himself in what used to be his office. The way I look at it, he did the world a favor. I wanted my shingle back. Some of the people I talked to said it could be done, but it would cost big money. More grease than I'd ever dreamed of. I had $40,000 in a safe deposit box. I decided I'd have to take a chance and try to turn it over. Double or triple it. So I went to see Ronnie Hanelli. Ronnie and I played football together in college, and when his kid brother decided on internal med, I helped him get a residency. Ronnie himself was in pre-law. How's that for funny? On the block when we were growing up, we called him Ronnie the Enforcer, because he umped all the stickball games and reffed the hockey. If you didn't like his calls, you had your choice. You could keep your mouth shut, or you could eat knuckles. The Puerto Ricans called him Ronnie Wop. All one word like that, Ronnie Wop. Used to tickle him. And that guy went to college, and then to law school. And he breezed through his bar exam the first time he took it. And then he set up shop in the old neighborhood, right over the fishbowl bar. I close my eyes, and I can still see him cruising down the block in that white Continental of his. The biggest fucking loan shark in the city. I knew Ronnie would have something for me. "It's dangerous," he said. "But you could always take care of yourself. And if you can get the stuff back in, I'll introduce you to a couple of fellas. One of them is a state representative." He gave me two names over there. One of them was the big chink, Henry Lee Su. The other was a Vietnamese named Solam Go, a chemist. For a fee, he would test the chink's product. The chink was known to play jokes from time to time. The jokes were plastic bags filled with talcum powder, with drain cleaner, with cornstarch. Ronnie said that one day, Lee Su's little jokes would get him killed. February 1. There was a plane. It flew right across the island. I tried to climb to the top of the rock pile and wave to it. My foot went into a hole. The same damn hole I got it stuck in the day I killed the first bird, I think. I fractured my ankle, compound fracture. It went like a gunshot. The pain was unbelievable. I screamed and lost my balance, pinwheeling my arms like a madman, but I went down and hit my head and everything went black. I didn't wake up until dusk. I lost some blood where I hit my head. My ankle had swelled up like a tire, and I'd gotten myself a very nasty sunburn. I think if there'd been another hour of sun, it would have blistered. Dragged myself back here and spent last night shivering and crying with frustration. I disinfected the head wound, which is just above the right temporal lobe, and bandaged it as well as I could. Just a superficial scalp wound plus minor concussion, I think, but my ankle. It's a bad break, involved in two places, possibly three. How will I chase the birds now? It had to be a plane looking for survivors from the Callis. In the dark and the storm, the lifeboat must have carried miles from where it sank. They may not be back this way. God, my ankle hurts so bad. February 2. I made a sign on the small white shingle of a beach, on the island's south side where the lifeboat grounded. Took me all day, with pauses to rest in the shade. Even so, I fainted twice. At a guess, I'd say I've lost 25 pounds, mostly from dehydration. But now from where I sit, I can see the four letters it took me all day to spell out. Dark rocks against the white sand. They say, "Help," in characters 4 feet high. Another plane won't miss me. If there is another plane. My foot throbs constantly. There's swelling still, and ominous discoloration around the double break. Discoloration seems to have advanced. Binding it tightly with my shirt alleviates the worst of the pain, but it's still bad enough so that I faint rather than sleep. I have begun to think I may have to amputate. February 3. Swelling and discoloration worse still. I'll wait until tomorrow. If the operation does become necessary, I believe I can carry it through. I have matches for sterilizing the sharp knife. I have needle and thread from the sewing kit. My shirt for a bandage. I even have 2 kilos of painkiller, although hardly of the type I used to prescribe. Oh, but they would have taken it if they could have gotten it, you bet. Those old blue-haired ladies would have snorted Glade air freshener if they thought it would have gotten them high. Believe it. February 4. I've decided to amputate my foot. No food 4 days now. If I wait any longer, I run the risk of fainting from combined shock and hunger in the middle of the operation and bleeding to death. And as wretched as I am, I still want to live. I remember what Mockbridge used to say in Basic Anatomy. Old Mocky, we used to call him. Sooner or later, he'd say, the question comes up in every medical student's career. How much shock trauma can the patient stand? And he'd whack his pointer at his chart of the human body, hitting the liver, the kidneys, the heart, the spleen, the intestines. Cut to its base level, gentlemen, he'd say. The answer is always another question. How badly does the patient want to survive? I think I can bring it off. I really do. I suppose I'm writing to put off the inevitable, but it did occur to me that I haven't finished the story of how I came to be here. Perhaps I should tie up that loose end in case the operation does go badly. It will only take a few minutes, and I'm sure there will be enough daylight left for the operation, for, according to my pulsar, it's only 9 past 9 in the morning. Ha! I flew to Saigon as a tourist. Does that sound strange? It shouldn't. There are still thousands of people who visit there every year in spite of Nixon's war. There are people who go to see car wrecks and cockfights, too. My Chinese friend had the merchandise. I took it to Go, who pronounced it very high-grade stuff. He told me that Li Su had played one of his jokes 4 months ago, and that his wife had been blown up when she turned on the ignition of her opal. Since then, there had been no more jokes. I stayed in Saigon for 3 weeks. I had booked passage back to San Francisco on a cruise ship, the Callis. First cabin. Getting on board with the merchandise was no trouble. For a fee, Go arranged for 2 customs officials to simply wave me on after running through my suitcases. The merchandise was in an airline flight bag, which they never even looked at. Getting through U.S. customs would be much more difficult, Go told me. That, however, is your problem. I had no intention of taking the merchandise through U.S. customs. Ronnie Hanelli had arranged for a skin diver who would do a certain rather tricky job for $3,000. I was to meet him 2 days ago, now that I think of it, in a San Francisco flop house called the St. Regis Hotel. The plan was to put the merchandise in a waterproof can. Attached to the top was a timer and a packet of red dye. Just before we docked, the canister was to be thrown overboard, but not by me, of course. I was still looking for a cook or a steward who could use a little extra cash and who was smart enough, or stupid enough, to keep his mouth closed afterward when the Callis sank. I don't know how or why. It was storming, but the ship seemed to be handling that well enough. Around 8 o'clock on the evening of the 23rd, there was an explosion somewhere below decks. I was in the lounge at the time, and the Callis began to list almost immediately. To the left. Did they call that port or starboard? People were screaming and running in every direction. Bottles were falling off the back bar and shattering on the floor. A man staggered up from one of the lower levels, his shirt burned off, his skin barbecued. The loudspeaker started telling people to go to the lifeboat stations they had been assigned during the drill at the beginning of the cruise. The passengers went right on running, hither and yon. Very few of them had bothered to show up during the lifeboat drill. I not only showed up, I came early. I wanted to be in the front row, you see, so I would have an unobstructed view of everything. I always pay close attention when the matter concerns my own skin. I went down to my stateroom, got the heroin bags, and put one in each of my front pockets. Then I went to Lifeboat Station 8. As I went up the stairwell to the main deck, there were 2 more explosions, and the boat began to list even more severely. Topside, everything was confusion. I saw a screeching woman with a baby in her arms run past me, gaining speed as she sprinted down the slippery canting deck. She hit the rail with her thighs and flipped outward. I saw her do 2 mid-air somersaults and part of a third before I lost sight of her. There was a middle-aged man sitting in the center of the shuffleboard court and pulling his hair. Another man in cook's whites, horribly burned about his face and hands, was stumbling from place to place and screaming, "Help me! Can't see! Help me! Can't see!" The panic was almost total. It had run from the passengers to the crew like a disease. You must remember that the time elapsed from the first explosion to the actual sinking of the Callis was only about 20 minutes. Some of the lifeboat stations were clogged with screaming passengers while others were absolutely empty. Mine, on the listing side of the ship, was almost deserted. There was no one there but myself and a common sailor with a pimply, pallid face. "Let's get this buckety-bottomed old whore in the water," he said, his eyes rolling crazily in their sockets. "This bloody tub is going straight to the bottom." The lifeboat gear is simple enough to operate, but in his fumbling nervousness, he got his side of the block and tackle tangled. The boat dropped 6 feet and then hung up, about 2 feet lower than the stern. I was coming around to help him when he began to scream. He'd succeeded in untangling the snarl and had gotten his hand caught at the same time. The whizzing rope smoked over his open palm, flaying off skin, and he was jerked over the side. I tossed the rope ladder overboard, hurried down it, and unclipped the lifeboat from the lowering ropes. Then I rowed, something I had occasionally done for pleasure on trips to my friends' summer houses, something I was now doing for my life. I knew that if I didn't get far enough away from the dying Callis before she sank, she would pull me down with her. Just 5 minutes later, she went. I hadn't escaped the suction entirely. I had to row madly just to stay in the same place. She went under very quickly. There were still people clinging to the rail of her bow and screaming. They looked like a bunch of monkeys. The storm worsened. I lost one oar but managed to keep the other. I spent that whole night in a kind of dream. First bailing, then grabbing the oar and paddling wildly to get the boat's prow into the next bulking wave. Sometime before dawn on the 24th, the waves began to strengthen behind me. The boat rushed forward. It was terrifying, but at the same time exhilarating. Suddenly, most of the planking was ripped out from under my feet, but before the lifeboat could sink, it was dumped on this godforsaken pile of rocks. I don't even know where I am. I have no idea at all. Navigation, not my strong point, ha-ha. But I know what I have to do. This may be the last entry, but somehow I think I'll make it. Haven't I always? And they are really doing marvelous things with prosthetics these days. I can get along with one foot quite nicely. It's time to see if I'm as good as I think I am. Luck. February 5. Did it. The pain was the part I was most worried about. I can stand pain, but I thought in my weakened condition a combination of hunger and agony might force unconsciousness before I could finish. But the heroin solved that quite nicely. I opened one of the bags and sniffed 2 healthy pinches from the surface of a flat rock. First the right nostril, then the left. It was like sniffing up some beautifully numbing ice that spread through the brain from the bottom up. I aspirated the heroin as soon as I finished writing in this diary yesterday. That was at 9:45. The next time I checked my watch, the shadows had moved, leaving me partially in the sun, and the time was 12:41. I had nodded off. I had never dreamed that it could be so beautiful, and I can't understand why I was so scornful before. The pain, the terror, the misery, they all disappear, leaving only a calm euphoria. It was in this state that I operated. There was indeed a great deal of pain, most of it in the early part of the operation, but the pain seemed disconnected from me, like somebody else's pain. It bothered me, but it was also quite interesting. Can you understand that? If you've used a strong morphine-based drug yourself, perhaps you can. It does more than dull pain. It induces a state of mind, a serenity. I can understand why people get hooked on it, although hooked seems an awfully strong word, used most commonly, of course, by those who have never tried it. About halfway through, the pain started to become a more personal thing. Waves of faintness washed over me. I looked longingly at the open bag of white powder, but forced myself to look away. If I went on the knot again, I'd bleed to death as surely as I'd fainted. I counted backward from 100 instead. Loss of blood was the most critical factor. As a surgeon, I was vitally aware of that. Not a drop could be spilled unnecessarily. If a patient hemorrhages during an operation in a hospital, you can give him blood. I had no such supplies. What was lost, and by the time I had finished, the sand beneath my leg was dark with it, was lost until my own internal factory could resupply. I had no clamps, no hemostats, no surgical thread. I began the operation at exactly 12:45. I finished at 1:50 and immediately dosed myself with heroin, a bigger dose than before. I nodded into a gray, painless world and remained there until nearly 5 o'clock. When I came out of it, the sun was nearing the western horizon, beating a track of gold across the blue Pacific toward me. I've never seen anything so beautiful. All the pain was paid for in that one instant. An hour later, I snorted a bit more so as to fully enjoy and appreciate the sunset. Shortly after dark, Oh, wait, haven't I told you I'd had nothing to eat for 4 days? And that the only help I could look to in the matter of replenishing my sapped vitality was my own body? Above all, haven't I told you over and over that survival is a business of the mind, the superior mind? I won't justify myself by saying you would have done the same thing. First of all, you're probably not a surgeon. Even if you knew the mechanics of amputation, you might have botched the job so badly, you would have bled to death anyway. And even if you had lived through the operation and the shock trauma, the thought might never have entered your preconditioned head. Never mind. No one has to know. My last act before leaving the island will be to destroy this book. I was very careful. I washed it thoroughly before I ate it. February 7. Pain from the stump has been bad, excruciating from time to time. But I think the deep-seated itch as the healing process begins has been worse. I've been thinking this afternoon of all the patients that have babbled to me that they couldn't stand the horrible, unscratchable itch of mending flesh. And I would smile and tell them that they would feel better tomorrow, privately thinking what whiners they were, what jellyfish, what ungrateful babies. Now I understand. Several times I've come close to ripping the shirt bandage off the stump and scratching at it, digging my fingers into the soft, raw flesh, pulling out the rough stitches, letting the blood gout onto the sand, anything. Anything to be rid of that maddening, horrible itch. At those times, I count backward from 100 and snort heroin. I have no idea how much I've taken into my system, but I do know I've been stoned almost continually since the operation. It depresses hunger, you know. I'm hardly aware of being hungry at all. There's a faint, faraway gnawing in my belly, and that's all. It could easily be ignored. I can't do that, though. Heroin has no measurable caloric value. I've been testing myself, crawling from place to place, measuring my energy. It's ebbing. Dear God, I hope not, but another operation may be necessary. Later. Another plane flew over. Too high to do me any good. All I could see was the contrail etching itself across the sky. I waved anyway, waved and screamed at it. When it was gone, I wept. Getting too dark to see now. Food. I've been thinking about all kinds of food. My mother's lasagna, garlic bread, escargot, lobster prime ribs, peach melba, London broil, the huge slice of pound cake and the scoop of homemade vanilla ice cream they give you for dessert in Mother Crunch on First Avenue. Hot pretzels, baked salmon, baked Alaska baked ham with pineapple rings, onion dip with potato chips, cold iced tea and long, long sips French fries make you smack your lips. 100, 99, 98, 97, 96, 95, 94. God, God, God. February 8. Another gull landed on the rock pile this morning. A huge, fat one. I was sitting in the shade of my rock, what I think of as my camp. My bandaged stump propped up. I began to salivate as soon as the gull landed. Just like one of Pavlov's dogs, drooling helplessly like a baby. Like a baby. I picked up a chunk of stone, large enough to fit my hand nicely, and began to crawl toward it. Fourth quarter, we're down by 3. Third and long yardage. Pinzetti drops back to pass. Pine. I didn't have much hope. I was sure it would fly off. But I had to try. If I could get it. A bird as plump and insolent as that one, I could postpone a second operation indefinitely. I crawled toward it, my stump hitting a rock from time to time and sending stars of pain through my whole body, and waited for it to fly off. It didn't. It just strutted back and forth, its meaty breast thrown out like some avian general reviewing troops. Every now and then it would look at me with its small, nasty black eyes. And I would freeze like a stone and count backward from 100 until it began to pace back and forth again. Every time it fluttered its wings, my stomach filled up with ice. I continued to drool. I couldn't help it. I was drooling like a baby. I don't know how long I stalked it, an hour, two. And the closer I got, the harder my heart pounded and the tastier that gull looked. It almost seemed to be teasing me, and I began to believe that as soon as I got in throwing range, it would fly off. My arms and legs were beginning to tremble. My mouth was dry. The stump was twanging viciously. I think now that I must have been having withdrawal pains, but so soon? I've been using the stuff less than a week. Never mind. I need it. There's plenty left. Plenty. If I have to take the cure later on when I get back to the States, I'll check into the best clinic in California. And do it with a smile. That's not the problem right now, is it? When I did get in range, I didn't want to throw the rock. I became insanely sure that I would miss, probably by feet. I had to get closer, so I continued to crawl up the rock pile, my head thrown back, the sweat pouring off my wasted scarecrow body. My teeth have begun to rot. Did I tell you that? If I were a superstitious man, I'd say it was because I ate. Ha! We know better, don't we? I stopped again. I was much closer to it than I had been to either of the other gulls. I still couldn't bring myself to commit. I clutched the rock until my fingers ached, and still I couldn't throw it, because I knew exactly what it would mean if I missed. I don't care if I use all the merchandise. I'll sue the ass off them. I'll be in clover for the rest of my life, my long, long life. I think I would have crawled right up to it without throwing if it hadn't finally taken wing. I would have crept up and strangled it, but it spread its wings and took off. I screamed at it and reared up on my knees and threw my rock with all my strength. And I hit it! The bird gave a strangled squawk and fell back on the other side of the rock pile, gibbering and laughing. Unmindful now of striking the stump or opening the wound, I crawled over to the top and to the other side. I lost my balance and banged my head. I didn't even notice it, not then, although it has raised a pretty nasty lump. All I could think of was the bird and how I had hit it. Fantastic luck. Even on the wing, I had hit it. It was flopping down toward the beach on the other side, one wing broken,